Okay, welcome tonight. Tomorrow night we will meet here, and then on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock we will be at 6500 Spring Valley. We'll go over there today with Mrs. Smith and spend some time. What we're going to do is Saturday morning at 9:30. Like you said, if you got time, come on over. And we'll just do some light training. We'll have done a lot of things and spend some time just getting it ready, and then spend some time eating together, and then spend a few minutes in prayer. And so it shouldn't take too long of your Saturday, but if you'd like to come over and join in a little fellowship work, and then some food, and then some prayer, we'll do that Saturday morning at 9:30. Just going by the things, I'll let you know tomorrow night. Tomorrow, some of us are going to go over and start working, just get a feel of everything, what we might need right away. And then once we get situated, then we'll start adding the things that we're going to need permanently. Looks very much like it did when I first moved into it. And really looking forward to it very much. And the work's been back at the church. There are a lot of churches, and I don't mean just a few. There are a lot of churches and a lot of people praying about our first Sunday at the 6500 Spring Valley. And a lot of pastors have called already this week and last week, and they and their churches are in prayer. So please be in prayer, and we'll just move on as has been planned. So I think that's the only announcement I really need to make tonight. We'll take care of business end of it tomorrow night, and don't want to take any more time tonight. Give the rest of it to Jerry Horton. Very honored to have Jerry come and speak with us. Most of you are already aware of some of the battle that a few pastors got into just by fulfilling the Word of God and supporting another believer in encouragement. And Jerry's going to take it too for being here, being prayer, and being prayer as we have been for his teaching in the school. And we'll get a report how everything went, and I'll give it to you Sunday of this week here. Usually it works out we have him on Thursday night in order to get a feel of how the week went. So I'll have to give you that report, or Mike will give you that report Sunday on how his week here in Dallas School went. Jerry, it's an honor having you here. Ranger Horton.
I won't play a song, guys. It's my new theme song. I'm five. I'd sing it, but I don't want to torture you people. I think you've already been through enough suffering for the rest. This is Charlie Daniels, by the way. The album is The Door, and I suggest everybody get this because it is worth its weight in gold. But this is one of the theme songs on here that I love very much. Thank you. scissors, didn't I?
We got one.
Well, please don't blame what happens tonight on me. Please don't blame it on him. He's got enough. He's got enough to keep the handle in this world. Yeah, blame it on me. But I'm not the pastor. I hope that if you're a stranger walking in tonight, I'm not the pastor. So don't judge what we do on the basis of what I say. I'm just a missionary. I've used most of you know me. I'm my family here now. And I love that song because occasionally we have to be brought back to reality in this world, and it's hard when you're out there and you're fighting this battle, and sometimes we get wrapped up in people, and people are always tough, by the way. But this is an amazing war, and I'm certainly not in this town to worry about Susan's size. I'm just glad the family still leaves the back door unlocked for me. And you people, along with this family in Dallas, have touched a lot of kids across this country. But since we're on the theme of this, I thought I'd give you a couple things that I collect. I like to collect these things that say a lot of things in a short way. Somebody gave me this. I love it. Oh, to be in heaven above with all the saints that we truly love. Yes, that will be glory. But to be here below with the saints that we know, now that's another story. We're not in heaven yet, are we, people? God knows this is not heaven. But the party has already started. The celebration of grace has already started. And there's no greater way to honor the Lord than to celebrate his grace and his victory and his ministry on the devil's front porch. Which is what I do all the time when I walk into public schools. It's obviously a very hostile place in America because that's where 60% of the violence on kids is now in the public schools. But I love that mission field because that's where I belong, and I hope I never get promoted beyond where I am. I just want to continue to do what God's called me to do as long as I can do it. And after I see what I've seen in the last 24 hours and what I've seen over the last 15 years, I'm just glad to be here, guys. I got another thing I read, I think, years ago here, but I thought I'd give it to you. This is handed to me. Why people give this stuff to me, I don't know, but you'll figure it out. Said, I dreamed of heaven the other night, and the pearly gate swung wide. The angel with a halo bright ushered me inside. And there, to my astonishment, stood folks I judged and labeled as quite unfit, a little worse, and spiritually disabled. Indignant words rose to my lips, but never were set free. For every face shone stunned surprise. You see, no one expected me. So it is a wonderful thing to know that we're all here by grace, and it's not what qualifications that we bring into this plan, it's what God provides that makes this plan so wonderful. This has been a long month for me. You know, February is supposed to be a short month, but not the way I do it. I started out a week in Louisiana. Again, thanks to some of you here in the ministry, and so we had a wonderful time over there. I did about 12 schools, and we really covered some interesting ground. Of course, I don't call Freeport, Louisiana. It's kind of East Texas to me. There's still some sanity there and a little bit of southern reality. I don't know if I'd ever want to get down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I don't know. I think that's where the movie Deliverance was filmed or something. I don't know. Arkansas, that was yeah. Thanks for not saying Alabama where I live. Have mercy, Arkansas. Is that still part of the United States, Arkansas? But I had a wonderful week over there with some great folk and great schools. And I had a retired superintendent of schools over there, an old Marine, travel around with me. And this dear man, Underwood is his name, Roy Underwood, he and his dear wife, by the way, have 68 years in the school system. So I'm talking about some serious warriors. But this guy, he traveled with me. He went to every school. He booked me and then went to every school with me. And it was amazing because the longer I spoke, the worse his voice got. Because, first of all, he and I are never quiet anyway, because every time we get together, we're always trying to tell each other some story that we both have either heard or know about. And by the time I got to Thursday, he didn't have much of a voice left. I said, are we going to make it this week?
He said, I don't know, man. I'll do the best I can. But he said, I don't understand why I'm the one losing my voice and you're doing all the talking. But I guess that's what happens when you're associated with people and you care about them and you sense their burden and the race that they run. And then I went back to Alabama and did five large high schools. One of them we videoed, which will be available to a lot of people. And we're also going to do another one in March, a large black school, in case some people don't think I can talk to black kids. To me, they're not black. I'm just the only white guy there. But you give me about 15 minutes in a black school, and they're going to forget what color I am. But we're going to have that available. We did some big schools in Alabama, Birmingham area, and we're back on that battlefield, starting to book again. And Chuck Farmer and some of my local team there have decided that if I'm going all over the country, why can't I go back and start doing schools I did back in the 80s, early 80s there in Birmingham? So we're taking back our home front again. And then I left there, and I went to Oregon. And you people were part of that because you remember last March when I spoke at Corvallis at a state FFA convention, that's Future Fighters, or Future Farmers to them. I call them Future Fighters of America. If you can farm, you know what you're fighting for anyway. And I spoke at that convention because of one young man named Aaron Denijian. Aaron took a year out of his life to be the president of the state Future Farmers of America, and he postponed an appointment to West Point. And this young man's only objective was to book me into the state convention for the purpose of exposing the FFA kids of that state to what I was doing, what I had to say about this country and about Christ. Of course, from that, my prayer was that God would open up doors and we would be able to do schools. Well, I just left there last week, and we did 12 schools in the middle of nowhere. You know, really up there in the northeast corner, right across the river from the state of Washington. And we did schools. We drove sometimes 150 miles to find some little town. And 95 kids from grade 7 to 12. I walked in those little schools and I look around and I say, you sure this is how Billy Graham got started? And that week was such an awesome experience because, you see, this young man who started all is now at West Point. And I talked to him about Thursday of last week, and I said, Aaron, you would really love to see the kids you touched this week. The privilege it was because of your testimony and your heart and your concern and your good decisions, your priorities as a young man. And, of course, his little brother followed me around most of the week, and we just had a wonderful time. By the way, it's the first time I ever remember sitting out on somebody's front porch, just relaxing, and looking at 40 deer about 50 feet away from them, and not trying to do anything about it. I mean, yeah, I just couldn't. I counted. It was probably more than that, but I just counted all these deer. They just come around there, stand around, and eat the foliage right in front in their backyard, and I'm sitting there thinking, I ought to be doing something about this. This is, you know. But anyway, it was a wonderful week, and I had a chance to stop and see some fine folk up there on the West Coast, Gary Glennon, who used to be in New Mexico when I did schools over in New Mexico, and talked to the Navajos over there. Had a wonderful time there. I think you guys remember some of that years back. He's now up in Portland. And Saturday, by the way, before I got here, they brought in about 35 people from all over the West Coast, doctoral types, obviously. And we had a wonderful time of prayer, and we talked about strategy and tactics, so I expect to get on the West Coast of Oregon, which is obviously a little different than the farm country, because most of the tree huggers live in the West Coast, you know, real liberal kind. Get a real emotional kick out of hugging trees and, you know, doing weird things like that, and worry about the ozone layer and all the other problems. And that's not really the battlefield at all. It's what's going on in the souls of our kids. So I had a wonderful week, and I didn't feel very good last week, and I really don't feel any better now, but I don't know what's wrong with me. I did something to my back, and I feel like somebody kicks me once in a while, so if I make a strange move and make strange faces, it won't be anything strange to you. I mean, when you got a face like this, what's strange? I love to pick on myself, by the way, in the school. I stand up and talk about laughter and how laughter is good for you and how that God has a sense of humor. Just look at the one sitting next to you. By the way, we did that in Dallas last March, you know, and two black girls jumped up and started trying to kill each other. And you know what was so funny? On the way to the assembly, I actually told one of the guys with me, I said, you know, the weirdest thing, we're talking about schools and different unpredictable things, and I said, you know, the strangest thing that ever happened. I said, don't ever get in the middle of a cat fight between two black girls, because it is the most violent looking thing you ever seen in your life. You don't even want to get near it. Just stand back, let the smoke clear, and hope somebody knocks the other one out before, so you can get in there and separate them. I no sooner said that, we walk into school, and I'm saying, you know, and doesn't God ever sense of humor look at the one sitting next to you, and these girls got up, teeth, hair, and eyeballs will start flying all over the place. I mean, Lord have mercy. I said, don't be upset by what you by somebody else's looks. I mean, you didn't pick your parents, did you? What the, you know? I tell them, look what I got stuck with. I look like a poster child for birth control. I think when I was born, the doctor looked at me and smacked my mother. My dad said, kill it before it multiplies, or something like that. So don't we all have trials, relations in this world? And I love to get kids laugh, and I talk about how you know you're redneck, you know. And I got a few new ones, you know. One of the ways you know you're redneck is your toilet paper has page numbers on it. You ever rake leaves in your living room? You have a can of Raid on your kitchen table? And your dad walks you to school every day because you're both in the same grade? Boy, that's a good one. That's too close to home for me. But anyway, I love to get into that. And, of course, I've been up in redneck country, you know. And I've even seen black kids, and I said, we got any rednecks in the house? No black kids raise your hand. Boy, there's a new kick for you. They don't even get the redneck jokes. But anyway, sometimes we don't get their sense of humor. But they had a wonderful week. And, of course, the schools we've been doing here this week just amazes me. This really amazed me. I did something today. I didn't have a good attitude when I first looked at the schedule. I had seventh grade of 450 kids, seventh graders this afternoon at 2:45. Now, that's a stacked deck, people. First of all, most kids don't eat a good breakfast, so lunch is a big, usually their big meal in the middle of the day. And what happens after lunch? You know, there's not a whole lot left. Seventh graders, 2:45 in the afternoon, in a gym. And I finally had to talk to myself, because sometimes it's not what you see. And I can't, no matter what I think is going to happen, it never happens that way. But as I teach, and as you people know, you don't cop an attitude, no matter what it looks like. You walk in there, and you determine before you go, all right, God, regardless of how I feel, regardless of what I see, this is what I expect you to do, because you brought me here. And that's that, it's amazing what you teach one day has to come back and kick you where you need it. Because if you don't believe you have to teach, eventually you're going to have to pay the dues anyway. But see, life, the soul, the brain, the attitude is either a thermometer or a thermostat. You see, a thermometer doesn't say anything, but a thermostat can. And if you transform instead of conform, here, you can change anything. And I love to walk in a situation, and especially when it looks absolutely bleak, and people, I've seen a lot of them. I've seen if signs is what you're looking for, I have seen the worst of them and still watch God turn things around. That's why we look not at the things that you're seeing, but the things that you're not seeing, because what you see is not always real. It's what you know that has to be real. But I'm preaching to the choir anyway, but it's been another wonderful week here. Spent another wonderful year. I did, by the way, in January, I spent some time down in Florida and down in over in Georgia in Albany with Mr. Bobby Joyner, who always sends his love and greetings to you through me. And then I went up to Ohio and spoke in 15 schools because the United States Army, recruiting command, guys that I've known many moons ago, are now up in Ohio, and they've got 87 high schools for me to do. Now, how long do you think it's going to take me to do 87 high schools? And the Army is asking me to do it. The United States government is asking me to speak to the school. And, of course, I was in the middle of nowhere, Ohio. I mean, I just, some of these little towns, you don't even know on a map. and these recruiters out there, you know, just trying to find a warm body or somebody who's got an IQ above room temperature to join the military today. And these guys just, what a privilege it was, because most of them didn't know me. Only the chain of command who booked me up there knew who I was and what I stood for. And all the recruiters came along and sat down, and I had a ministry with them, because it's been a long time since anybody told them how valuable their service is. And if you can serve in the United States military under the present administration and be professional, you're a strange and a wonderful breed. Wonderful soldiers to do that. They're better men than me. I don't think I would consider myself very, very loyal in uniform to what we got in the White House. But the principle is there. The principle is that, thank God, we still got the people who say, I look beyond the man. I look at the mission. See? And then you can focus. You can keep your balance. You can do these things. But I'm so thankful for these guys out in the middle of nowhere and being able to get up in that part of the country. By the way, I think I could spend the rest of my life just doing schools in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Iowa. Just absolutely, you think those Yankees up there are dead? They're not. The kids are wide awake. The kids are hungry. But I've got 10 more states. I'm up to 42 states, gang, and I want 10 more before I die. I want to be able to say that I spoke to a kid. Sometimes I'm getting desperate enough to just drive across the border, grab some kid at 7-Eleven, and say, you got 5 minutes, son, because I want to talk to you just to say I was here. But I want schools in these areas, and I want to be able to leave tapes in every state and let some kids get them. And thank God we're able to do that. And one of the tapes that's got so many miles is one that I did in your church many years ago on the Eagle. That tape is still going out. And so I'm so thankful that you guys were eager to tape that. I wouldn't want some of the things I did in your church to go out there to my kids, but, you know, it's another ball game. But now, these are interesting times. These are tough times. One of the things that I've been telling young people lately is that there's two things that I think kids need to see themselves. There's two ways I want you to see yourself as a kid. Now, adult, I'd like that to happen to you, but I think for some of us in this country, that's going to be awful tough to do. The two ways that I think we ought to see ourselves, number one, is that God needs to show us ourselves through the eyes of the cross. I mean, we need to see what we look like through the eyes of the one who died, while he was dying. Because when you see yourself there, you're going to have a real reality check, because there are no illusions at the foot of the cross. And by the way, while you're there, you're not going to be preoccupied with who else is going to be gathering around. What about this guy? What about this one? Boy, you need to be here. I ain't got room for that. If you and I ever see ourselves through the eyes of the cross, I would not be here tonight, people, if God didn't show me that. And he showed it to me when I didn't want to see it. That's got to be the toughest gut check in your life. To have the moral courage, the divine tenacity, however you want to call it. Say, God, I want to see myself through your eyes. No illusion. Not what other people think. Because the buck's got to stop somewhere, and it's not going to stop until, my friend, you and I can see ourselves through his eyes. That's the only way we're going to get over the non-essentials, the hype, the psych, the games that people play. Now, it happened at a very difficult time for me. You say, you can't, I said this, because, see, I had a very miserable teenage life because of one man. I let one human destroy me. Happened to be a minister. Happened to be a hypocrite. I was 12 years old, and I'll never forget the experience. Because my best friend was a black kid named Russell, and we studied terribly. See, people didn't pick on Russell because he was black, or pick on me because I was white. They picked on both of us because we talked funny. We baptized everybody. We studied terribly. It was a joke trying to talk. Except, you know, when Russell and I got together, we never studied. We never studied. We felt that kind of closeness. He lived behind me. I'd walk out my back door, he'd walk out his front door, we'd take 10 steps, we'd meet. Best thing ever happened to me. You know that boy. We played ball right next to the church where I attended. One day I knocked the ball up there, and Russell ran up there to get it, and my preacher came out and said something. I couldn't hear. I knew it hurt Russell. And Russell just picked up the ball and started walking toward me. And I saw the look on this young boy's face. We were about 12. I said, "Russell, what's wrong?" His eyes were teared up. He says, "That's your preacher." I said, "Yeah, I go there. Because my dad's bigger than me, you know. I go there. Why does that man hate me? Because I'm black." I said, "What? He what? Why does he put me down because of my color? He's your preacher?" I walked over to the house and I stood there and watched the back of that church people, and within a matter of minutes, I was a different human. I had turned so hard, so cold, so indignant. I was a dangerous kid from that day on. And through all of those years, I was dedicated myself to do one thing, to show that every Christian was a con artist. But they were, none of them were real. None of them were honest. It's all a game. You know something? I exposed a lot of idiots. I did it. I worked hard at showing hypocrisy in Christians. Until I went to a rescue mission, youth camp. And I'm going to tell you something. When you work with the derelicts of this world, you work with the people on the bottom, you don't play games very long. These people were so real that when I tried to puncture their little game, when I tried to expose them, when I tried to turn the light on them, it blinded me. You know what scared me to death? I found out there was people out there that really had the real thing. But I had ways of ignoring that because I had my father. And I never saw any Christianity in my dad. The only time my dad was human, he'd walk into that little church and put on that little smile and sing those little songs. "Where they lead me, I will follow. What they feed me, I will swallow." You know those songs. "Like a mighty tortoise. Like a mighty tortoise moves the church of God, brothers, we are treading where we always try." Remember that? Yeah, I'm saying. I am that. I used to tell kids, "I don't get it. I don't believe in this stuff." One church says there's no hell, the one across the street said the hell there ain't. They didn't teach me that. But I read any of these folks. But all those years of antagonism and bitterness, being judgmental, being critical of this man, hating what he did, what he represented, destroyed me. Until one night I had to work with my dad, and we worked at a very dangerous place. It was an aluminum anodizer plant down in Miami. Very dangerous job because there were big tanks of acid. I mean, I'm talking 30 feet, 40 feet long, 15 feet deep, 8 feet wide, filled with nitric and sulfuric and caustic acid. I still got lung damage because that was before EPA. Anybody told you to wear a mask or something to protect yourself? It's like being, can you imagine working 8 hours a day around ammonia? That's what it felt like. And one day a load of metal, we had these big cranes, big pulley systems with cables, and one of those steel cables broke, and so I took it on me to save that load of $20,000 worth of aluminum. So I got up on a big platform over all of these vats of acid, and I got up there and I used a hand pulley when nobody else would do it, and I pulled that load up and tried to save it. Of course, when I went back to get down from this platform over this, I managed to touch a live wire and about killed me. Literally picked me up off the ground for a few minutes. And then my father, my brother was there. And my younger brother, and he just went berserk. He thought I was dead. And he wasn't the only one. And all the noise, my father come running. Finally, he cut off the electric power, and I fell on this platform. About 3 hours later, I think I remember coming to. My right arm did this for about 3 days. You know, a little strange. But my dad mocked me that night. Shamed me in front of everybody. Pushed me to the limit. A week later, I was going to do the world a favor and kill him. And I had it all planned. By the way, in my mind, he was a dead man. I had gone over so many times. Because, see, you got to know my dad. My dad is a very, very hard man. When you grow up in coal mines of West Virginia, you can't afford to be soft. By the way, my granddaddy had a philosophy that if you laughed and if you cried, you were weak. There was no place in this world for emotion. That's what my granddaddy brought up, my pop. Well, I didn't know that. And I let all of this build up till I was 3 feet away from beating him to death with a pipe. Until God decided, well, this idiot has got lost control, and I'm going to have to intervene. And God stepped in that night and saved my dad and saved me. The most amazing thing. I don't care how you want to debate it, but God stepped in on that situation. Literally grabbed, something grabbed my right arm. Like this. And I couldn't move it. It was locked. By the way, when your arm's like this, you can't hold anything. You know? You can't do it. And so the pipe fell out of my hand, and I all of a sudden, instead of, you know, trying to beat my dad to death, which I had all the plans and all the desire to do, I started beating my arm against the wall, cursing my right arm because it gave out on me when I needed it the most. I was all of a sudden, all my anger went against. Of course, my dad saw me there and drug me outside, trying to find out what was wrong. Then he slugged me. And I told him what I thought about him for the first time in my life. Told him everything. I'm talking about years and years and years of bitterness and self-pity and self-centeredness and arrogance. And it all came out. And my dad did the last thing I ever expected him to do. He prayed. I never forget what I saw. I saw me. I never looked so low and gutless and useless in my life. I saw me like I've never seen me before. And then I saw my dad. And I realized my dad was not my pop. My preacher was not my pop. I was my pop. God kicked me every way but loose that night. I walked out a different man. I walked out a different guy, 19 years old. I was never the same. I even told my dad for the first time that night I loved him. And I said, you don't know how to love, Dad. But I'm going to teach you. I don't expect you to love me. See, my father and mother never said a kind word to me in my life. They didn't ask me. It made more sense when I finally got it from the one who really believed it, my Lord. I began to hear his grace toward me. And I said, hey, my mom and dad, they don't know how to express love. But now I know. So I did. I taught my parents how to love. I taught them how to hug. We'd never hugged growing up. That was terrible. I'm wrong with guys and, you know, hug people. And I saw myself that night through the eyes of the cross. And it was pretty sick. Very, very sick. Now I'm able to stand in front of kids across this country and none of them intimidate me. None of them cause a reaction to me, really. Because I've yet to find a kid that looks as ugly as I did. As sorry as I was. Selfish, self-centered, bitter, antagonistic. What a mess I was. And I tell you, that was surgery for me. That was painful. That's why I want kids to see themselves at the cross. And by the way, when you're there, ask God to show you a little bit of what Christ must have felt like when God the Father forsook him. By the way, until somebody you love forsakes you, until you've been hurt and stomped by people, you'll never understand how great Christ is, what he went through. See, I recently realized, thanks to my pastor, he taught a Bible class not long ago that explained to me why this country's in a mess. Christians do not want to suffer. We don't want to suffer. We want all the blessings. We want all the prosperity. We want to see God do great things. But when's the last time a Christian that you knew of literally suffered for righteousness' sake? Strength and the testimony and the boldness for the Lord. We don't want to suffer. In 2 Philippians 1, we're not only just asked to believe in him, but to suffer. Anybody want to volunteer for that duty? But when you're able to see what Christ can do it, and you see your real self through his eyes, it will change your world. By the way, it will give you an attitude that you can tolerate people no matter what. You'll have compassion instead of being cold and callous. You'll be compassionate and caring. That only comes through pain, by the way. That only comes through pain. The only people I know that know how to love people are those who suffered because of blood. Those who have been kicked around. Those who have been abused. Those who have been maligned. Compliment. I heard a wonderful story. I'll go true story about a guy named John Griffin. In 1929, John Griffin lived in Oklahoma with his wife and his one-year-old boy. He had wonderful plans. This man wanted to do some traveling in the world. He wanted to cover a lot of ground. But John, because of the stock market crash, because of the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma, they had to pack up what they had in a little car, and they took off and went east and stopped at the Mississippi. And he got a job. He ran... He worked for the railroad and got the job as worked as the drawbridge conductor over the Mississippi River when all the great ships would come through there. And for the railroad company, his job was to make sure that the drawbridge on the rail would be lifted at the proper time and then brought back down for the trains to cross the mighty Mississippi. And he got this job, and he was there in 1937 when his boy was only 8 years old. And his boy always wanted to know, Daddy, what you do? He told him about this tremendous job he had, raising and lowering the bridge for the railroad. He led all these great ships. He said, some of these ships, you know, are carrying goods all over the world. And so one day he took his boy with him to work that morning. And right before lunch, they took their little lunch, and he walked out on a big catwalk out there on this mighty, mighty bridge embankment. And of course, the rail was lifted, the bridge was lifted, and the ships were coming through, and the father was sitting there with his boy, and he was all of a sudden telling him, son, this ship is on the way to the Middle East, and this ship will be going to Central America, and these ships go here, and man, it was a wonderful day, and this kid was just fascinated with all that, and they were eating lunch, and finally, time got away with John, and all of a sudden he realized that he started hearing the noise of a train. He began to realize that the 107, the Memphis 107, was about to cross with 400 passengers on it. So John just said, son, I'll be right back. So John Griffith took off and started running to the control tower. What he didn't know, his little boy followed him. And his little boy slipped and fell in the gearbox. The gearbox that handles the mighty steel gears that actually work the bridge. He slipped and fell in there and got his leg caught in those gears. And the father went in there, and the father was looking to see how many more ships had to go through, and he had to time it to see where the train was coming. And just about the time he was about to lower this, he happened to look over it, and he saw his boy down there. The panic that set in his heart. The train now was obviously whistling, saying, please lower the thing, man, we're coming. And then for a minute, they said, John looked up and he saw a rope, and he figured, if I could get that rope, maybe I could climb down and I could pull my boy out. And no sooner did he have the thought and he realized there wasn't time. And his boy was screaming for his daddy to help him. He had a choice to make. Do I sacrifice my son for all these strangers that I don't even know? You see, John knew that he had no choice. As true and sad as this story is, this man buried his face into his arm and lowered that rail bridge, even after hearing his son's body being literally ground and crushed and destroyed. He even looked up as the train finally went by, and he saw all those people in there. He saw men reading newspapers and women sipping tea and kids waving, and they couldn't see the broken heart of the man who just sacrificed his son to save those lives. You know, we rarely stop and think, what did God literally have to go through because our redemption mattered? Do you ever take it for granted? Ever become second nature to you? Is it ever second nature to wake up one day and realize, I am a child of God? God even has my picture up in his throne room somewhere. You see, when you see yourself at the foot of the cross, it's going to be a great awakening. By the way, America needs to see itself there. America's going to have to see itself in a way it doesn't want to see it, because this country has flunked the test of prosperity. And we do not want to stick our neck out. But the second place that you need to see yourself is on resurrection morning, when one woman, who most people wouldn't think was very important, a lady who could not anoint the body of Jesus on Wednesday evening when he died, so I believe he died on Wednesday evening. She didn't have time, because by 6 p.m. on that Wednesday was a holy day, the Passover, and nobody could catch a dead body or go to a graveyard after 6 p.m. So they had to wait till Sunday morning, 72 hours later. And see, the Jewish day starts at 6 p.m. It doesn't start at 1 a.m. or 12 midnight. It starts at 6 p.m. and ends at work. So by 6 p.m., Jesus had to be in the tomb. So on Sunday morning, not afraid of the Romans, not afraid of the edict, not afraid of the guards at the tomb, this little lady went to the tomb. The angel told her, "Lady, who you want? Who you looking for? He's not here." Of course, the lie that the Jews and Romans had spread had already got to her, that someone stole the body. And so she just was brokenhearted. And little Mary was brokenhearted as she was outside the grave of the tomb of her man. And weeping, she said, "If somebody will just tell me where you took him, I'll be glad. I'll bring him back by myself. I will literally carry his carcass back and put it in that tomb." And this woman meant enough for him that he stayed in the graveyard after the resurrection. Just for her. I remember her emotions got in the way, and she thought he was one of the gardeners, one of the guys, you know, that dressed up the graves, and being in an emotional state of revolt there, and having her feelings all twisted, she couldn't see that it was a man of a dream. She said, "Sir, do you know where my dead Lord is? Would you tell me if I can bring him back?" Remember Jesus' response? "Hey, Mary, would you take me if I was alive? How about the real thing? I hate to disappoint you, but I'm back." Remember her response when she jumped up and grabbed her? "Yeah, that lady knew a man once you met him. I said, 'You gotta let me go, darling. I got angels, I got the throne room, I got a lot of people sitting about waiting for me to, you know, want to know where I am. They're not gonna believe that I stopped everything just for you,' but he said, 'I did.'" Can you see yourself at that place? You see that you matter that much to him? Individually sitting here tonight, you matter that much to him. He cares that much about your feelings, your heart, your devotion, your love, your service. So you can't stay at the foot of the cross, because, man, that don't give you a whole lot of self-esteem. But on Sunday morning, when you see what the Lord has done for us, when we see what he's given us, when the kids of this country hear me stand up and talk about it, wasn't MacArthur, it wasn't Schwarzenegger who said, "I'll be back here with you." They didn't believe it. Any more than some people believe he's coming back now. That's why I love this MIA bracelet I wear. Not just the guys in Vietnam, but the one that says Jesus Christ 33 AD. I give it a few years there, but he has been missing. But he's coming back. They're born. Coming back. I don't think I have to convince you people, regardless of your theology or anything else. We ain't got a lot of time. By the way, I just discovered four things God doesn't know. There he is. Only the evangelist would come up with something that's off the wall anyway. An omniscient God who knows all. I got four things he doesn't know. There he is. God did not know sin, he doesn't hate. Because that's what he did to his boy. But he doesn't know second, he doesn't know a sinner, he doesn't love. That's what he means. God does not know another way for you to have everlasting life apart from faith in his boy, Jesus. God don't know another way for you to get saved. Is that all this noise I'm wearing? Looks like an Indian and all that stuff. Huh? My empty tomb and a few other things kids give me. My wife says, you look like a gypsy and all that stuff. Huh? Yeah, it all means a lot. One is a little Indian arrow with an eagle on it that a boy out of Oklahoma gave me one day. He said, I've had this since I was five. But he said, I want you to have it because I don't need it now. You pointed me in the west. I'm a Christian now, and I want you to have this arrow to remember me. Another one's a little nickel that's been crossed out and has a cross on it. You know, a little girl gave it to me in Iowa. The other one is an eagle on the anchor. See, Jesus is the anchor. And God is the eagle, the character of the eagle. And my precious wife gave me. And the other one is an empty tomb that Bobby Joyner made down in the beaches of Florida, where he sat down there and put together little seashells and made me an empty tomb. When I stand up in the school and say, I don't wear a cross, I wear an empty grave. That crucified a lot of people. But only one ever walked out of death row on Sunday. He said, I am the resurrection and the life. By the way, I love it because I say, by the way, if you don't agree with my answer today, but, you know, and if I've offended you, don't be offended unless you got something better. You got something better? Then, hey, listen to me. Let's talk. If you can beat an empty grave and the victory of a cross, if you can beat those two things, if your faith is in somebody who killed sin and death in a weekend, then let's talk. Because I'll make a deal with you. But I have got no takers, and I never will. But I'd love to say it anyway. You want to shoot me down? Let me see what kind of gun you use. I love that story about the guy that went to D.L. Moody years ago and said, sir, I don't think I like your evangelistic techniques. And D.L., being a humble man, said, well, sir, what techniques do you have? He said, well, I don't have any. He said, well, I like the way I do it a whole lot better than the way you don't. That's one of them. Just so good I can stand in front of these kids around this country and tell them about Christ. I had a teacher walk up to me today, by the way, and you're going to love this sermon. She was crying all of a sudden. I told her about Bruce King. She said, I graduated from Bryan Adams High School. I knew who Bruce King was. I never knew how he died. She said, it hit my heart out. And then you talked about his letter, and I knew he was a believer. And then you talked about Jesus. She said, this is one of the greatest days I've had in years, putting all that together. And you walked in my school this afternoon, and you told those kids something that everybody in this school needed to hear. I can't believe who you are and how you got here. So y'all know who Bruce King is, the airborne ranger that died in Vietnam in 1969. April 9th is his anniversary, 26 years. Last time, by the way, I was at Brian Adams. His daddy was there. And Herman and so many of you wonderful people joined me that day. I don't know how many of them. But remember, his father was there that day, and he walked out of the assembly after the kids applauded his presence and handed me a box. He said, don't give it back. Whatever you do, don't give this back to me. Even if I call you up and beg for it. He said, don't look at it until I'm gone. He said, doctors say I got 6 months to live. So I'll probably never see you again on this plane. But he said, you keep my boy alive. And he walked off, drove away, and I opened it up, and he gave me the medals that came off of Bruce's uniform and the flag over his coffin and all the pictures left. He said, I don't want nobody else to get a hold of this. He said, you've been keeping him alive all these years. Keep him alive the rest of your years. He said, next time you come to see Bruce, salute me. I'll be ready next time. I love to tell those things. I had a teacher come up to me in Louisiana. She said, you know what you did to me today, son? She said, I can't believe this, but she said, everything you talked about has been in the back of my mind for a long time. And you know what you did? You reached back and pulled it around and put it back in front of my face again. I haven't seen those things in years. She said, I needed that as much as a kid. She said, you know what I'm going to do? You know that teacher I talk about that has that bulletin board in his classroom, and he goes in and has all the faces of his heroes, and he talks about that's why he's a teacher, because these people are the ones that motivated him and gave their life for him. And he said, I look at them every day before the kids get here because, you see, if I can keep them alive, then I'm going to do something for these kids. At least I'm going to get my bold boy up there. Because I got those kind of people, too. I'm going to put them up in my classroom. Yeah, that's a wonderful idea. I just love it when I run into some of these wonderful people, one of these amazing soldiers. Well, I want to say some of the word tonight just briefly as I leave. I just thank you for the sweet guy. More than you know. I'm also doing tonight what I do all the time when I stand in front of an audience. I swallow all of my feelings. All the frustration, all the pain, all the burden, all the things that I have to carry, all the things I see, all the lives of the kids that I see that sometimes make it tough for me to sleep at night. I stuff it all. Because I'm very upset about what the enemy's done. But I'll tell you what I do. I don't know God who's going to learn from all this. But you better keep teaching me. I want to learn from all of this. So I hope you guys keep taking notes about all this mess. Because one of these days you might be able to sit me down and say, let me tell you what I learned. See, let me tell you what God taught me in the middle of all this storm. Especially I want to read this guy's diary. Not all of it, just the part he wants to share with us. You don't want to read all mine. I said this with a kid this week. I give it to you. This is how, one of the ways that I deal with the test. Philippians chapter 4, verse 6. If you want to look at it, there's some P's here I'm going to give you. I'm going to give you a letter P. I want you to see it. This is how I categorically deal with some of the things that gets heavy with me. Just the way you do, I go to what God thinks, because God's the only one that's got the answer to all this mess. Now, I don't have the answer. I think I do. And the more I know, and the quieter I get, the smarter I know God's teaching me. The wiser I am. Not to try to judge. Not to try to figure it out. In Philippians 4, verse 6. And I know you know this. It says, don't worry about anything. Don't be anxious. Don't be fretful. Don't sweat it. However you want to put it in the Koine English. Don't be anxious or worry about anything, but everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your request be made known. Tell God what you really want. But the key there is don't worry. Take it to Him in prayer. The second P, promise, and the peace of God that surpasses human comprehension or human reason or human intellect. God's peace cannot be described or necessarily explained. It surpasses all knowledge. Peace, he says, of God that surpasses all comprehension shall guard. I like the word guard there because the word I'm going to use is another peace. It will protect. It will protect your heart and your mind. It'll guard your mental attitude, but it also guards your heart because you can't separate the two. Because often the heart is the response or the reaction of the mind. We all have a choice in life. No matter what happens, we either react or respond. Usually reaction means we're going to lose because that's emotionalism. Response means I don't have to understand it. I can accept it. Because God knows what He's doing. He doesn't have to explain it to me either. He knows what He's doing. See, that's the beginning of wisdom. Point one, there's a God. Number two, I'm not Him. Isn't that the book of Job? Didn't Job finally get it after about 40 chapters? Let me see if I got it now, God. You're still God, and I'm not, and that's cool, okay? That's cool. The only reason we get upset is because we're trying to tell God anyway, aren't we? I want to know what's going on. I want to understand all this stuff. Look, You're not supposed to understand. You're supposed to trust. If you understood it, you wouldn't trust it. If you understood everything that went on, you wouldn't trust God. You wouldn't live by faith. I don't have to trust him. I already know all this. You see, that's smart. You're in trouble. You have to live by faith. Not by smart. Remember in Matthew 18, when Jesus wanted to humble the disciples, who got into an argument about who's the greatest? He brought in a kid. He says, now, I want you to know about this kid. He's got a doctorate in theology. This kid's very brilliant. No. This kid knows big people in big places. No. He said, until you humble yourself like the kid, you ain't even going to get to the kingdom, let alone worry about who's going to scramble for the big chair. You're not going to get the back door unless you think like this kid, until you humble yourself as a child. Okay. Prayer, peace of God that surpasses knowledge, will protect. Now, let's get to the next piece. Finally, verse 8, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, lovely, of good repute, good respect, good report, and of excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, let your mind dwell on this. Praise. Now listen to me. One of the most profound things I've heard in the last 10 years is God does not need servants. He's got a lot of them. He's got them standing around at parade rest, waiting for jobs to do. God don't need service. You know what he wants? He wants to be worshipped. He wants to be loved. He wants to be praised. We don't know how to praise God very often. We're not good at that. Because we start thinking, well, I know a group of Christians who do that, and I think they're a little weird. Why? Because they get emotional about the Lord? Can you actually have a strong love that's not emotional? Is it possible? Can you tell me something you really love that doesn't touch you at all physically or emotional? Huh? It's academic, right? Oh, I know the word impersonal. You know that word doesn't communicate. You can't love without it touching you. By the way, how many times you see Jesus Christ was moved with compassion? You think when you move with compassion that that doesn't involve some emotion? Trust me. It does. Move with compassion means something catches you so that you've got to do something about it. Not stand by like the Pharisees, you know. When the Good Samaritan, I mean, when the guy was caught on the road and beaten half to death, and remember the big theologian that came by and says, I thank you, Lord, that in your sovereignty you have appointed others to deal with things like this. Huh? Can you feel the man's pain? Okay, I get distracted. What's worthy of praise? Let your mind continue to dwell on these things. Now, ready? One more piece. And the things you've learned and received and heard and seen in me. Wow. Paul said, you've seen them in me. Practice. Practice. These things and the God of peace to continually be with you. Don't worry but pray. God promises peace. He promised to protect you under pressure. Learn to praise him and keep on doing this until you get it right. One time a guy said, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? Someone said, practice. Practice. Keep on doing it until you get it right. Do it till you do it right. One guy sang a song one night, someone said, sing it again. But sing it again. The guy said, why do you want me to sing it again? He said, I want you to sing it till you get it right. Anyway. You know, I keep on doing school until I get it right. Because I don't ever think I always do it right. The day I think I got it right, I'm in trouble. Today I think I got it all together. I don't have it together. Well, I just love you guys. I'm just thankful for your life. I thank you that you're part of me. Some of you not only support my ministry in a marvelous way, you pray for me. Some of you help keep me alive. I actually feel better tonight because of somebody in this room gave me some good advice. I get a lot of good advice. I just don't always take it, but it's good when I do. So how do I say thank you? How was that? So I can touch every kid I've touched in the last 3 years. Whether it be with a coin. By the way, I know Smith, you're going to appreciate this. I walked into a school in Oklahoma. I'd been there in about 4 years. The principal walked up to me, reached his pocket, pulled out that coin I gave him and said, I think about you every day, man. Welcome back. Welcome back. Blew my mind. The little metal coin that I gave him, you know. America's a land of the free, only as long as home of the brave. And in John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him will not perish, but have everlasting life. Kids I have around this country who carry these things every day and pray for me now, no wonder I can't fail. Well, it's wonderful, God. Ladies, appreciate your heart. Appreciate the valleys you live in. The valleys you need, not the mountaintop. Mountaintops are dangerous. Prosperity turns cowards into the bravest soldiers. The valleys keep us humble. But it's only the valley of the shadow, not death, it's just a shadow. Satan's a big bluffer, isn't it? Scare a lot of people, never touch them. A lot of people scream, never get hit. Duck, never get swung at. I hope we suffer. I hope God lets us suffer for us. Thank you for just remembering me. Let's pray. Father, would you continue to use your word in this group, and would you continue to heal, and would you continue to vindicate grace, and would you, Father, give us all an accountability. Father, if we don't face you now, if we don't let you show us ourselves at the foot of the cross, and then let your grace and mercy outside of the resurrection tomb, if that doesn't affect us, then we're all going to be casualties. We're all going to be distracted. We're all going to be bought or sold. Father, you've got some things you need to do. My prayer is you do it with me. You start with me. And continue to work in these lives. Help them to focus on you. Not on people. Not on personalities, but on you. The author and finisher of our faith. Father, your Son is where our eyes need to be kept. So help us keep our eyes on the Son. Thank you for your Son. The Lord Jesus. For those who come tonight, who are hungry, who are gracious, who are part of me and the kids I've got, let us continue to do it till Jesus comes. In his name I ask you. Thank you. Amen. Have a good night. Thank you for your time.